Today's interview brought to you in part by Blue Microphones Yeti Blackout, the ultimate professional USB microphone. Welcome to the show, Greg, and thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Hey, it's my pleasure, man, and thanks for having me.
All right, well, let's journey back to Baltimore in the time before you discovered the Beatles, and tell us what the music scene was like.
Well, I'll tell you what, when I was about 13 or 14, I found a broken guitar in the alley out back of my house. We lived in a row house, and I took it home. I tried to fix it, didn't work, so make a long story short, my mom took me down to the pawn shop and we bought a guitar. I saved up my money. It was a $40 guitar made by Kay, I remember. And I could play pretty much three chords on it. You know, the same three chords I've been playing my whole life. and I'm still doing it. It's still working, man. You know, it's amazing what you can do with three chords.
Well, do you happen to remember the first time you were on stage, you know, played in front of people?
Yeah, I do. Actually, in my, this was back in the folky days, pre-Beatles, all right? And we found a guitar out back of my, in the alley behind my house. So I got a regular guitar a couple of weeks after that, and my cousin, who lived about two blocks away. My whole family lived within four blocks of each other when we were growing up in Baltimore. Like my grandmother, my aunt was down at the end of the block. My grandmother was two blocks away. You know, it was like growing up in happy days, you know. my cousin got a banjo. And so we started a little folk duo, me and my cousin. I remember we had cards printed up. We never played a gig, by the way, but we had cards printed up, the Voyagers. That was our name, the Voyagers. And, you know, we did stuff like Tom Dooley and, you know, it was really bad stuff. And it was all three chords. Later in life, when I saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, which was a major turning point in my life, I saw and I realized that the same three chords for the Kingston Trio were the same three chords for most of the Beatles songs. And that I could take those same three chords and play most of the Beatles songs. So I was plugged in right away. And by the way, this was in the days when we were so sexually repressed. We were so, like, if a girl even talked to us, we'd sprout pimples. You know what I mean? If a chick touched us, we would, like, doing, we'd, like, grow a pimple right there. And the only time that guys like me and my cousin, you know, not the sharpest tools in the shed, the only way we could get chicks was by playing guitar. And you know what? We started out at a place called Patches 15 Below. It was a coffee house in the basement of a little strip mall. And we used to go out there on Sunday nights because they had a hootenanny, and you could sign up. Everybody got 15 minutes. So my cousin and I went out there. We were kind of scared, basically. But we went out and did it, and you know what? I felt like I loved it. And I really got over my stage fright right away. I mean, within one or two gigs. And ever since those days, I've always felt comfortable on stage. Never got tongue-tied or, you know, never, yeah, I just always felt good.
When you walk out on stage and you're putting your guitar on it and the audience lights up for you, what does that feel like?
Oh, that's a wonderful feeling. First of all, you know, the reason that you play live is largely ego, because, you know, you're playing for you're preaching to the choir. You're playing for people that already like you. And it's a wonderful thing. Look, I'm not putting it down. I love playing live. As a matter of fact, that's the most fun I think that there is if you're a musician, playing live. You know, as the years go by, this is a heritage band. I mean, we formed the Greg Tin Band back in 1975. That was the first album. And then the second album was 76, I remember. And then we kind of made an album every year after that for the next 18 years. But, you know, we were a heritage band. I mean, we felt like we were making art. We weren't really in the music business to be superstars. We just wanted to play at the local clubs, have fun, make records, write songs. It was a more of an art thing. And, you know, back in those days, you really didn't entertain visions of glory. It's not like nowadays where, you know, everybody, you make it just to make it. You know what I mean? Just to be famous. Back in those days, you made it, you know, because you had something to say and you wanted to play. And I tell you, I still love playing live. And the best thing about it right now is I got a brand new band. Only been together for about a year. I got my son Rye on lead guitar. He's got big shoes to fill because he's filling in for Joe Satriani and Jimmy Lyon. Rye was a student of Joe Satriani when Joe was in the band. Rye was taking guitar lessons from him. So he kind of came up the right way. And then Rye went on to Berklee School of Music and was a jazz guitar major and graduated from CalArts as a jazz guitar major. So he really knows guitar. I mean, he's really good, which is really funny because I'm as lame as I ever was. I'm still this guy doing three chords, but my son can play, you know, he can play rings around me, and it's great. And then we got a new drummer, a guy by the name of Dave Lauser, and he's on loan from Sammy Hagar's band. Sammy's a good friend of mine, and I needed a drummer. Our guy couldn't go on the road, and I had used Larry Lynch, our original drummer, on a couple of cuts on the album. But I was really looking for somebody that could go out on the road and, you know, into the flow of touring. And Dave Lowser was available, and Sammy said, "Hey, look, why don't you use Dave? Because I got to do this chicken foot thing, and then I got a tour, and then I'm going back into the studio to do this, that, and I won't be using him until like probably next spring. So why don't you take Dave, go on the road with Dave, and tell you, man, I don't want to give him back. He's too good of a drummer, man. The guy's like, he's like Keith Moon. He's very busy. A lot of eighth notes, man. I love the guy. And then on bass, we've got Robert Berry, who was also the producer of the last Greg Kim album, Rekindle. And, you know, Robert's one of those guys, he plays every instrument in the band. He plays keyboards. He's really a good keyboard player. Plays guitar, plays bass, plays drums, plays slide guitar, plays everything, plays marimba. And so, you know, he kind of fills in what we need on the song. And we went into the studio, and the first song that we cut for the new album was Big Pink Flamingos. And I remember the first day, we just went in there. Rye had this great guitar riff. He said, "Well, check this out, Rye. Check this out, Dad." But, he started playing the riff that was going to become Pink Flamingos. I said, "Dad, that's a great riff." And I started singing Big Pink Flamingos just out of the clear blue sky. I don't know why. I don't know where. I was like, it was floating around, and I just snatched it out of the air, and I channeled it through my body, and we wrote that song in like 15 minutes, and that set the pace for the whole album. The whole album, it was really, the songs wrote themselves, and it was very organic. That's why I think, as Greg Kim albums go, this is one of the best ones.
Seems like it's a journey back to the 80 ones, a little bit different than like Horror Show.
The 80s was the time of the MTV. And I remember the first couple of years of MTV, we had been one of the first guys, you know, this is just in the very beginning of videos. When the breakup song came out in 81, they didn't have videos. We had a live video at the country club that was shot live somewhere. That was it. But by the time 83 rolled around, you couldn't have a hit record without having a hit video on MTV. So we made the Jeopardy video. We were one of the very first concept videos that actually told a story. You know, because most of the videos at that point were, you know, fake live, you know, guys with big hair playing fake live, or chicks in lingerie running down alleyways and stuff like that. It didn't have any punch. We were the first ones to actually have a concept and a storyline. And the storyline, like, I remember like it was yesterday, we had a big band meeting, and Joe Day, who was director of the video, said, "Well, what are you guys into?" And they were like, "Hell no, I don't know." And then I said, "Hey, you know, I'm into creature features. I like, Night of the Living Dead and old horror movies and stuff like that." And it could perfect. So we did the video for Jeopardy as a kind of a parody of the Night of the Living Dead. And it was real fun because, you know, first of all, we did it at a real church after hours, the Mission Dolores Church in San Francisco, which is a famous church that was used in the Dirty Harry movies. And they let us use we got it for a 48-hour straight shoot. No gas, just 48 hours, and we had I know in my heart that I'm going to go to hell for all the things I did in that church after hours. My God, that was during our heavy partying phase. I mean, we were doing stuff in the church that, you know, you don't do that stuff. So I'm sure that we're going to go to hell for all that. But we had a great time. We made a great video. We had a lot of use those cheap tricks that guys like Roger Corman, you know, the B-movie, Roger Corman, William Castle, people like that, would use really cheap special effects. Like, we had a scene where the floor opens up and this giant snake comes out and wraps around me. It's like this giant serpent, and it's huge. It's like, you know, 2 feet thick, and it wraps around me and starts dragging me into the orifice. We didn't know how we were going to do the shot, so we did it in reverse. We wrapped the snake. The snake was made out of latex rubber, So, you could have a little give in it. So we tightly wrapped it around it, shot it in reverse. When we let go of the snake, it went... And it looked, and when we played it in reverse, it looked like it came out of the floor and wrapped around me. It really looked good. So we did a lot of, like for instance, the snake blood was pea soup, Campbell's pea soup. We had guys off camera with squirt guns shooting Campbell's pea soup in my face. but it looked great on camera. And, this is one of my philosophies in life, because I've done a lot of stuff in my career. All of it's been a million to one odds against me. It was a million to one odds that you would ever make a hit record and, do it yourself and a little mom and pop label and have a number one hit. That was a million to one. And then it was a million to one to write and publish, six novels. It was like, oh, you'll never do that. It's too hard. But I did it. I don't know how I did it. I just did it. It was the same thing when I started doing the morning show at K-Fox. I had to get up at 4 in the morning for 18 freaking years. It drove me crazy. By the way, since then, I've been sleeping until at least 11 every day since then. But, I just felt like all of the jobs that I did, they were fun. They were things I'd do anyway. My interest, for instance, I loved writing. Writing was always something I did going back to junior high school. My mom, well, bless her soul, she's gone now, but in the storage space at my sister's house, there's boxes and boxes of old notebooks from, going back to junior high school and high school, of terrible, horrible songs that I was trying to write, but I kept at it. My thing is, you got to do it even if it sucks, because nobody's great the first time out. If you want to be a songwriter, or you want to be a novelist, or you want to be on the radio as a broadcaster, just do it. Just, don't worry about how hard it is. Don't worry about how the odds are against you. Just do it and enjoy it. And you know what? I was blessed that everything that I tried, was fun, and I could do it.
You mentioned those terrible songs. Isn't it one of those terrible songs that your mother entered into a contest?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, God bless my mother. She was very supportive of me. And when I was about 15 years old and I got that first guitar, I was into Bob Dylan. The three-wheeling Bob Dylan album had just come out. And me and some of my buddies had bought the album, and we fancied ourselves little junior Bob Dylan. I had a harmonica thing and everything. And I wanted to write songs like Bob Dylan, it was social conscious stuff. And, he was writing stuff like Blowing in the Wind and Hard Rain's Gonna Fall. And I wanted to do that. So I started writing, basically really bad love songs to my girlfriend. I remember the first song, and I did, it was called Song for a Pretty Girl. And it was just terrible. It was like, hey, pretty girl. Hey, pretty girl. And it was just, I don't even remember, but it was awful. And I had a little Wolinsack reel-to-reel tape recorder that I got for Christmas one year. And I used to go into my mom's bathroom and close the door because it was really great acoustics in there. In the shower stall was all tiles. So I would go up there with my guitar and the tape recorder. I cut demos in the bathroom, in the shower stall. Because it sounded pretty good in the shower song. So one of those horrible songs that I wrote, my mother, unbeknownst to me, my mother heard about this talent contest on the local Top 40 station, WCAO, in Baltimore. And she entered it. I had no idea. She sent it in. And I won. I don't know how it happened. And I won three things that affected my life to this day. One of them was a Vox electric guitar, which I still have, which is a great thing. An electric typewriter, way before, the Apple Classic or the Apple iMac. It was like, he got these, I think they were made by Wolinsack. I don't remember. They were an electric typewriter. It was really cool. I started banging out stories immediately. And I got a stack of records, which I wound up playing on the radio. So it was kind of like kismet, you know, and my mom was at the center of it. I mean, I really miss my mom, but she always was very supportive. I remember when we were just starting out, and Joan Jett's a good friend of mine, and she was from Baltimore at one point. My mother knew Joan, and because my mother went to every gig, and Joan used to open for us all the time. I remember a gig that we did in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, way back in the, in the late 70s, early 80s, and we did it. My mother walks up to Joan Jett, who just had walked off stage. She was all sweaty. And my mother, she means well. God bless her. You can't, you know, she's your mother. What are you going to do? She walks up to Joan Jett. She goes, "Honey, you're such a good-looking girl. Why don't you smile? Smile a little bit. Is it going to kill you? You smile, and the world smiles with you. Everybody will smile." And I said, "Mom, you don't tell Joan Jett to smile. She's not a smiler. She doesn't smile. I don't remember a single picture of Joan Jett smiling. Actually, she's very serious about her art." And my mother, "Just smile, honey." So every time every time Joan would see my mother for years afterwards, go, "I'm trying to smile, Mrs. Kidd." But it's not easy.
Sounds like you had some great parents. Your father wrote a letter to Dick Clark to thank him for having you on?
Yeah. You know, that was amazing because we've been on the Dick Clark Show half a dozen times. Gee, I don't even remember the first time we were on. But the first time we were on, the second time we were on, Dick Clark calls me into his office and he goes, "I got something I want to show you." And he's got a letter from my father framed. In his office, framed, cool. Saying, "Thank you for having my boy on your TV show." And Dick said, "You know, we've had probably 2,000 or 3,000 bands over the years. You know, American Bandstand has been around forever. We've had thousands of bands. I never, ever got a thank you letter from a guy's father. This is the only one." And he had it framed. And then every time I saw him after that, he would always reference that. In fact, I remember a couple of times we were on there, he goes, "How's your dad? Tell him I'm still, you know, I still got that thing on the wall in my office." And it was kind of a trip, man, because, you know, I was just an average guy. I wasn't a great guitar player or a great songwriter, but, you know, somehow I enjoyed doing the things that I did, and I turned it all into a livelihood. I don't know how I did it, but I did it.
You'd been on all the big shows of the time, and you had hit records, and when you found out Weird Al wanted to parody you, did you see that as a sign that you'd really made it?
Yeah, I did. I was very flattered. Weird Al called me up one day out of the clear blue sky. He says, "Hey, I want to do a version of Jeopardy." Because, you know, he has to get your permission if he's going to parody your song. And by the way, I asked him, I said, "You know, absolutely, I want you to do it, and I'm really flattered that you chose my song, and et cetera." I said, "But, you know, just for the record, Al, has anyone ever turned you down?" And he said, "Yeah, in all the years," and, you know, because he had Michael Jackson calling him up in the middle of the night with song ideas, you know. Everybody wanted to be parodied by Weird Al. The only guy that said no was Prince. But you would figure that because Prince really, I think, kind of takes himself seriously. And, you know, maybe he didn't think, maybe I think they were going to do a Purple Rain takeoff. So, but I loved his version of I Lost on Jeopardy. And being on, you know, doing a cameo appearance on the video was even more fun because I was on the set for Jeopardy and I got to meet Don Pardo, and oh, it was really a thrill.
Let me ask you about one more show of the day, and that's, you were on Saturday Night Live with Howard Cosell.
Yes, Howard Cosell. He was great. You know, we had, for some, well, I don't want to say anything bad about Howard. I loved Howard. He was my idol. People loved him. I mean, and they also hated him. The cast didn't care much for Howard. They found him pompous and stiff. But I loved him, And so they gave him the dressing room directly across the hall from my dressing room. We were isolated from the rest of the cast. You know, we were like off in a corner somewhere because nobody wanted to hang out with Greg Kinn and Howard Cosell. But he spent the whole, and so, you know, when you go on Saturday Night Live, you got to be there the whole week because they run it through, you know, they do a live run through 4 or 5 times. So they rehearse the thing, usually Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and then they shoot it, an early show Friday, and then the real show Saturday night. So, you know, you have a lot of time to ponder. The whole time, he was in his dressing room, right across the hall. I could look right in. He had the door open, drinking a bottle of Old Granddad and watching hockey on TV. And so I walked in, you know, I said, hey, I want to introduce you to my band, Howard. And he had heard of band. You know, he was a nice guy. And he said, sure. He come in, and I go, here's Dave Carpenter, and here's this guy, and here's that guy, and here's the my bass player, Steve Wright. Steve Wright was my bass player at the time. And he goes, Steve Wright, University of Utah, 1973, winner of the Golden Globe Award for Best Linebacker. What happened? You had everything and you blew it, did you? Blew it. What happened? And I said, Howard, different Steve Wright. He goes, oh, never mind.
Oh, that's awesome.
He was a trip. We would be eating. They catered the thing. The whole week was catered. And they had some pretty good meals. You know, they brought in good caterers. I always sat next to Howard. Nobody else wanted to hang with him. Me, I sat next to him. So, and he would critique the meal while he was eating it. It was completely Howard. He never left character. He was always Howard. He was going, well, this meatloaf, I wouldn't give it to a dog, but these peas are out of this world. You know, and he would just go on and on about it. Look at these potatoes. My God, how many more lumps than just did all, and he was always on, and he was always telling stories. Did I ever tell you about the time that Muhammad Ali, tell me about it, Howard. So for a whole week, I got to hang with Howard. You know, now that he's gone, you look back on those episodes, because, you know, that was a great cast with Billy Crystal and, oh, God, remember Ed Grimley? And it was just great. Howard just fit right in, man. He was never out of character. He was always Howard.
I noticed that you've got your entire album up on your YouTube channel. Let me ask you a question I've been asking the last few artists. With the music industry basically non-existent, is there really any benefit to you or any other artist to record and release a full album?
Yeah, you know, that's a really good question, because I think more and more the answer is no. It really is. We had the 3 or 4 videos that we made, you know, right off the bat for this album, Pink Flamingos and Life I Got, and I think it was Cassandra. And they just kind of jumped out at people. But, you know, apart from the 3 or 4 main songs, really, a lot of it's left by the wayside because it's too much to play it on the radio. I guess you could slip it in on podcasts and so forth. But it seems to me that the whole nature of the music business has changed. I mean, let's face it, I've been around doing this thing since 1975. I mean, God, I was 12 years old when I started, I think. I don't remember. But anyway, I've been doing it forever. And I've seen it come and go. I've seen, you know, we made vinyl, we made 8-tracks, we made cassettes, we made CDs. You know, we saw the revolution go from 15-inch tape, magnetic tape, to computerized, from analog to digital. Everything's changed. And I think the way that they market the music also has changed, because right now you offer these things. Most artists are offering stuff free on their websites. Why? Because they want people to listen to their material. They want people to listen to the songs and, you know, forget selling 1 million records. That's for Janet Jackson. for the rest of the world, it's like, listen to me, listen to my song. I got something to say. To me, I think it was easier. Back in the day, back in like 83, you know, we always thought we were artists and we would have hit records and that was great, but we weren't really in the hit record business. You know, we weren't like nowadays, all these young bands and singers and so forth, they're doing this. They're in the record business, or I mean the music business, just to be famous. That's it. You know, they want to be famous. And, you know, it's not like they've got something to say. Really, it's like right now, it's people are just famous for being famous. And I think that's the wrong reason to get into the music business. We certainly didn't get in here to get rich. You know, it seems like all these guys nowadays, they're just looking to get rich. And boy, can they get a lot of money too. Can you imagine the amount of money that we would make on a hit 45 on vinyl compared to the amount of money that, like, say, you know, one of these young singers right now with like one or two albums, but when they got hundreds of millions of downloads, I mean, they're instant success. You know, suddenly they're Beatles. You know, to me, that was the gold standard, the Beatles, you know. But now, like, people come out of nowhere, they have an incredible career, and they disappear into nowhere, and it's like, what happened? Who was that? What were they doing?
Continue on with the music industry being different. You know, the groups like yours that I saw in the 80s, by the time I saw you, you know, you had played 600 or 700 times. So you were fantastic. Yeah. Where does a new band hone their chops?
Yeah. Hey, listen, something happens around your 1,000th gig. You know, we tried to figure out recently how many gigs we'd done, and we gave up after 2,000 or 3,000. But something happens around gig 1,000. You hit levels of tightness that you could never have imagined. You know what I mean? So, yeah, these young guys that are having a hit record, and then they go on the road, and they're playing, you know, Coliseum-sized venues. They don't really have the background and the chops to pull it off. That's why there's a lot of pre-recorded material being used in live material now. And I think that, look, when I go to see something, I want it to be a special musical moment. You know what I mean? I want to see Ray Charles be Ray Charles. I want to see Van Morrison be Van Morrison. You know, I want to see some really magical musical moments. I don't want to see rehearsed stuff with lighting cues. I don't want to see dancers, you know, in lockstep. I don't want to see that. I just want something that touches me in my heart of hearts. And that, to me, that's what the music business should be and probably always will be to one extent or another. But it's got to touch you, man. It's got to, you know, like Bowie used to say, there wasn't one damn song that would make you break down and cry. And it's true. And, you know, I don't know who said this. This is a great quote. I don't know. I'm going to give you a great quote. But I don't know who said it about me. I don't even know if it was about me. I think it was. But it was somebody like, I have no idea. Some crazy journalist said, the road to rock and roll heaven is paved by the bleached skulls of guys like Greg Kinn. You know, that really, that's it. That's it. My bleached skulls have paved the road to rock and roll heaven, and thousands of others like me. You know, we've all been in there, we've all been chasing that dream.
You know, when you've played a song like the breakup song 1,000 times, and maybe 3 or 4 times that week, how do you make it fresh for not only you, but, you know, for the young kids in the audience that have never seen you before?
You know, I never have a problem with that song. It always sounds fresh and new. Even when, you're right, I play it 4 or 5 times a week, and it still sounds fresh and new to me. I never get tired of that song. I don't know if it's the ah-ahs or something in there. It's something in there is timeless. Now, other songs are difficult to sing, have become difficult to sing over the years, like Jeopardy, which is, you know, kind of high for me to sing now, so I got to struggle to hit some of those notes. But the breakup song has always been a pleasure, and I just always loved the uh-uhs. And, you know, people come up to me, I travel the world, and people can come up to me in Tokyo and in Paris, and they go, oh, yeah, I like that, because it translates into every known language. Is universal. And somebody will come up to me in Tokyo, and they go, oh, you know, guy, I love that song. And I was like, yeah, thank you. I always meant to finish those lyrics. I was just filling in the ah-ahs because I didn't have enough lyrics, and the guys in the band said, hey, those are the deepest lyrics you've ever written, man. Don't change a thing. That stuff's got to be spontaneous. And, you know, I used to love to leave spontaneous stuff in the records. I know that another thing, a trend with young singers and bands these days, that they make perfect records. They fix every mistake. It's flawless. It's shiny and beautiful. But, you know, back in the day, we used to leave mistakes on the record. You know, the Stones used to leave mistakes. So I say, fuck it. It sounds great. And just leave it on. So we did. I mean, there's lots of great mistakes back in the Greg Kin catalog. That's just stuff that we left in there because it had soul and it just worked for me. You know, it's amazing to me. The songs that wrote themselves, and I say this over and again, you know, Jeopardy, the breakup song, Lucky, Pink Flamingos, Cassandra, all of these songs, they wrote themselves. You know, I sat down, somebody had a guitar riff, maybe me, maybe Rye, maybe Robert. Somebody would have a guitar riff, start playing it, and I would sing something out of the clear blue sky, and 10 minutes later, I'd get my notebook out and jot down some lyrics that were always, they were always work lyrics. Oh, just getting some work lyrics. And then, you know what? The work lyrics became the real lyrics. After a while, you thought, man, I can't do it more succinctly than that.
When a young person writes that song, how do they go about owning it?
Well, you know, I think you've got to be completely natural and let the song come out organically. If it comes from you and you're channeling the song out of the air like that, you know, that's my theory would be. I think, you know, really, you've got to be yourself. I think being yourself, being relaxed, and being honest, you know, I know a lot of songwriters, and some guys, they could write the kind of lyric that'll make you cry. You know what I mean? It's just like Jonathan Richman's a great example. You know, here's a guy who can write anything. He can write, you know, he can write a song about the doorknob, and it would make you cry. So to me, Be true to yourself, be yourself at all times, and let the song organically grow. In other words, don't have preconceived notions. Let the song write itself as much as you can. Because when that happens, that's the most pure writing. And it goes not only for songwriting, but it goes for novel writing, it goes for talking on the radio, it goes for everything. You know, when you're saying something real and you're saying it from the heart, you don't have to be Pavarotti, man. You just get that message goes right through.
This is either going to be right on target or the most bizarre question you've ever had. As I've prepared for this interview and I've gone back and listened to your albums, are you a Phil Spector fan?
Oh, yeah, love Phil. Love Phil Spector, yeah. And, you know, since we started back in the days of analog and wound up in the days of digital, you know, we used to record on Ampex 2-inch magnetic tape, and we used to do edits and stuff with a razor blade and a knife. You know, that's how we used to edit. Now we just mark it and do it on Pro Tools, and the computer does everything for you. But back in the day, man, you had to have, we had a guy named Dr. Schnoz who was our Ricky Corsello, and he was our engineer for the breakup song and around that era. And he used to have this beautiful case with a scalpel. It was a razor blade, actually. It was a fold-out, old-time razor blade, really sharp, which he used to make edits on the master tape. You go, look, I'm going to cut the tape. This is the only one. Wish me luck. And, you know, he would make a big show out of taking out the scalpel and, you know, taking it out of the box and wiping it down. And, you know, he was like a doctor. He used to put on a white lab coat to do his slices. It was fun.
Do you think because you can tweak around with it more? That you do, and is that a good thing?
Well, you know, it does end. There's a you go to that point of diminishing returns. Like if you can fix every single note, you know, I go out and do a vocal. Maybe 99% of it's pretty good, and I just blow one note. You know, the old Greg would have just left it in there. I don't care. The new Greg probably would have tried a couple of takes, and if we couldn't nail it, the brand new Greg would just go to Pro Tools and fix the damn thing. And you know, it's really weird, like, oh, I can't do this first verse. I did it the best I ever did. I could never okay, let's just take it out and put it here on the vocal track. So you're back, you know, you can do anything. You're a miracle maker. But you don't want to do everything because that just hurts the finished product. And I like the fact that it's a little rough. You know, if you listen to Stones records, there's lots of great mistakes in there. And that was part of the charm.
The last question before I give you the closing is the same for every artist. And you sort of touched on them, but can you share a Spinal Tap moment with us?
Oh, God, I got millions of them. Oh, let me think about one. Let's think about a good one. Okay, I got a good one. How about the drug sniffing dog story? Okay, we're playing out. This is back in the 80s, back in probably 85, 86. We were out on the road somewhere in the Midwest. I believe the name of this town was Hobart, Indiana, I think. I'm not sure. And they were having Hobart days where they, it was like, you know, the Pioneers came and they it was only a one stoplight town, but they would block the one street and set up a band, you know, and we played, right? They paid us, we played. And this place was so small, they didn't have a motel. There was no motel in this town. So anyway, we get in there and there's delay, and it was a rainy day, and we were supposed to play at 1, and then there was a delay, and then we were supposed to go on at 2, and then there was another delay, and then we were supposed to go on at 3, and it was another delay, and the crowd was getting all antsy, and so you leave my guys alone for 3 hours in a Winnebago in the middle of nowhere in Hobart, Indiana, and there's only one thing that can happen, and it's not good. So my guys, except for the drummer, my guys were all partying animals, and we just got ripped. We got ripped 6 ways from Sunday. By the time they opened the Winnebago door, it was like a Cheech and Chong movie. Smoke comes billowing out. The band guys come staggering out. Oh, is it time to play yet? So we go up on stage, and the mayor of the town comes up and he says to me, I got a little something that we're going to present to the chief of police, so just be ready to go and then start, you know, when I'm done. So we get up on stage and we plug in and we're waiting, and here comes the mayor. And he's got the chief of police with him.
Oh, no.
And this huge drug sniffing dog. and it's like that's Chief Oshevsky, the proud denizens of Hobart, Indiana, we'd like to present you with this brand new drug sniffing dog. And it was this huge, it was like you could have put a saddle on this thing. It was like a German Shepherd, but it was just mutant. It was huge. And of course, he walks on stage and he makes a beeline for me. And he starts sniffing my pocket. And I'm thinking, oh my God, the dog just busted me. And I could see the chief of police thinking. I could tell the way his mind was like, let's see, what's going on here? And, I mean, and the dog is nuzzling my pocket. So I didn't know what to do, so I just started playing. I said, 1, 2, 3, 4, boom, and we went into the first song, and that dog jumped 10 feet. I swear to God, that first chord just knocked the socks off of him, and he took off for, and I don't know, he may still be running, I don't know. But it took, and then when we got finished after the second encore, we got directly into the car and drove away. We didn't even go back into the Winnebago. We knew that there was a bust in the air. But that's the famous drug sniffing dog story.
That is a great one. Well, in closing, Greg, is there anything you'd like to tell our listeners?
Yeah, I'd like to say that, you know, it's never too late. You've always got a chance. You know, I think if there's a message on the new album, Rekindled, and by the way, you can get everything at gregkin.com. I always forget to say that at the end of the interview, but you can get CDs. You can get any of my novels. You can get signed stuff. You can get anything. Just go over to gregkin.com. There's blogs, there's news, there's tour dates. If you ever want to see if we're coming to your town, or if you're in Hobart, you can check it out on the gregkin.com website. But in closing, I'd like to say that, you know, if there is a message here, it's that you never give up. You know, life is always full of adventures and new things, and you got to keep growing and keep reinventing yourself as you go along. And if you do that and you don't take yourself too seriously, you're going to have a great life. And believe me, I've had a great life. I've been blessed. I've had all these great careers, and you know, I get to go out and play with my son. Come on. How many? And then in 10 years, I'll have my grandsons also. So I have three generations of kin in the band. Would that be a trip?
So are you kicking out Robert or David?
Oh, no. the two brothers, when they come up, when they get to be about 17. No, Robert, he's in the state. Hey, listen, there's only one way to leave the Greg Kin band, and that's like Keith Richards would say, in a box. Because we lose guys. I mean, of the five guys that cut the original breakup song, that was in 1981. There's only two guys left standing. There's only two guys left alive. Oh, is that amazing?
Wow.
It's me and Larry Lynch, the drummer. And Larry was the guy that always drank milk, didn't drink, didn't do blow. You know, he was a clean liver. And I would have been the guy that you would vote first off the island. This guy's going to die before he's in his 30s. But somehow I've survived, and I'm still here, and I'm still got my health, and I'm pretty healthy, and life is good, but it's a miracle that I made it this far, my friend. And my goal is to keep going and see more generations of kin get out there and dominate the musical landscape.